Well, we're going to jump back into our church history. We had a bit of a break last week, and we are going to try, our time is limited, but we're going to try to cover the beginnings of the Reformation in England, both in England and in Scotland. So, for me at least, there has always been a lot of, shall we say, romance and lore surrounding Luther and Calvin. I've read multiple biographies of Luther, at least one good solid of biography of Calvin, but I don't know as many details just personally as I come into this about the Reformation in England and in Scotland, which is kind of a shame because, you know, our country was started by English colonists. So you would think that more naturally we would know more, or I would know more about the Reformation in England. But nevertheless, we have this outline that can kind of guide us, and maybe we can fill in a few of the blanks if you have questions. So Henry VIII, what is Henry VIII famous for? Correct. He split away from the Catholic Church because they would not allow him to actually annul his marriage. So the Catholics never give any countenance to divorce at all, but they will annul. They will annoy your marriage too, but they will annul some marriages. What else is he famous for? Yes. go ahead. Right, he had a lot of wives, and some of whom died suspicious deaths. So, oh, it could be. There you go. There's a lot about this that I don't know. So, you guys are going to fill in the blanks. So. All right. So, he has a reputation for being ruthless. Well, here we go. Henry VIII supported a break with Rome primarily for political reasons and personal reasons, not for religious reasons. So basically, he wanted this annulment of his marriage to Catherine. He had married his brother's widow, and he felt as if that should be a reason to have it annulled. There would very often in our, I guess that's legal. You can marry your brother's widow. Yeah, that's legal. But he felt like there was enough grounds there to have the marriage annulled. The real reason that he wanted it annulled is they could not seem to have a boy, and he wanted a male heir. They did have one girl, and her name was Mary, and we will come to her later in the story. She is the one who comes to be known as Bloody Mary. All right. So he also wanted more power for the English crown and less papal interference. So here's kind of what happens, bottom line. 1534, the English Parliament enacted laws that forbid payments to Rome, so no more tithes can go to Rome. They declared Henry's marriage to Catherine to not be a true marriage, and they made the king the supreme head of the Church of England. They also declared that whoever claimed that Henry VIII was a schismatic, in other words, he was dividing the church, that they would be guilty of treason. So they are elevating the need for loyalty to the crown, and they are breaking away from the Catholic Church by act of Parliament. All right, which, you know, at this time in history, that's happening, right? The Reformation is already well underway. It's at full steam at this point. But it took some guts to do this. It took some guts to stand up and say no to the Catholic Church. But they have been, you know, wrestling, pushing back against the Catholic Church for a long time. All right, let me finish up with Henry VIII, and we'll pause after that. Initially, he was not sympathetic to the Reformation as it was taking place on the continent. In fact, he had written a treatise against Luther and the Pope had commended him for that. However, we remember Wycliffe. With his influence and the followers, his followers who were called Lollards, his followers and their influence and his writings and that sort of thing, and the new influence of Lutheran ideas, all of this is beginning to kind of gain circulation in England. And so this break with Rome, this more or less political slash personal break with Rome, gives people hope. Protestant-minded people, they have hope that perhaps there will be an opportunity for deeper changes. And so some Christian people, you know, evangelical Christian people, support Henry VIII in his very sort of politically selfish desire to break with Rome. They support him in his policies in hopes that a real spiritual change can happen in the churches in England. An example of this would be the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer. But for the rest of Henry VIII's life, the toleration for Protestants kind of went up and down, depending on his personal political whims, as well as according to the attitude of his current wife at the time. Okay, so they had different beliefs and input, and they also had their own political agendas. And so they may not have been making any stand for what is right or what they believed. It might have just been for their own political expediency. However, during this time, these Reformation ideas are beginning to take root, and Thomas Cranmer, N before the M, he ordered a translation of the Bible into English, and he ordered them printed and one placed in every church so that people could find it and read it. So it wasn't just up on the pulpit. It was somewhere that people could read it. So that, for whatever reason, political and personal, the Reformation began in England. Any thoughts or questions on that? That comes later. So remember, the Act of Parliament was in 1534. So this is a different Bible, a bit different translation under Cranmer. The King James Bible is published in 1611, so almost 100 years later. But he did it, I think, you know, either for his own personal desire to encourage Christianity or under the influence of bishops and pastors that wanted to just spread Christianity. He also had some political reasons. So he wanted to strengthen the divine right of kings. And so there were some things in the translation that he wanted to see happen. And he wasn't satisfied with previous translations into English because they may very well have leaned towards less divine right of the kings. So, but that's coming up. That's King James in the 1600s. Anything else? Yeah. This one? Yes, so the Geneva Bible is what you're thinking of. So very often, because, you know, the most popular English Bible of all time is the King James Bible. And a lot of people think, well, it was in 1611 and, you know, our colonies are just starting around that time here in the United States. And so we assume that the Puritans and the colonists brought the King James Bible over with them, but they did not. They brought the Geneva Bible over. And it's called the Geneva Bible, I'm pretty sure, because it was either translated or printed there, but it was in English. And so that helps me answer a little bit more of Jim's question. James, King James, Deacon James, Deacon Jim, whatever. So the reason, one of the reasons I'm pretty sure that King James wanted the Authorized Version, which is its real title, translated was it. So he wanted to influence it so that it supported the divine right of kings, because the Geneva Bible was a lot more egalitarian in its translation. And just by virtue of translation, you can tent the way people interpret certain verses, like obeying the king or whatever. And the Geneva Bible had a lot of notes in it, which I think he really objected to the notes, because it would have said something like, we obey the king when the king is serving God, you know, and when the king is following the truth. And he didn't like that. He wanted them to obey him no matter what. But those kind of rebellious, rascally colonists and Puritans, they didn't bring that King James Bible. They brought the Geneva Bible, which gave them a lot more sort of room to flex their muscles politically. Yeah, go ahead. So you know, just like the ESV is a little bit different from the King James, is a little bit different from the New American Standard, is a little bit different from the New International Version. Whenever you put together a translation committee, they will actually create a translation philosophy. Okay? And here's a couple of examples. The translation philosophy of the King James leaned more strongly towards word-for-word translation. The translation philosophy for the New International Version, which of course comes hundreds of years later, leans more towards a thought-for-thought, idea-for-idea, meaning-for-meaning translation. And therefore, you know, of all the most popular translations, there's the greatest difference between the King James and the NIV, because they have two very different translation philosophies. They're both valid, but they are different. Okay? So every time you translate the Bible, it is going to have different ways of saying basically the same thing. And so you look at this one, ordered by the Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, and it's going to read differently. Just the sentence structure and the vocabulary are going to read differently. It's going to read differently than the Geneva Bible, than the King James Bible, than the Wycliffe translation. It certainly would read differently than a modern English translation. They are supposed to basically mean the same thing. However, hopefully I don't rock your boat too much. We were taught in Greek class that any translation is also a commentary. Okay? And here's what they mean by that. You look at the Greek text and you very often come to points where you say that could be translated this way or it could be translated that way. So, for example, certain Greek words are spelled the same. Let me start this way. Normally, a Greek verb is spelled one way if it is in the indicative and a different way in the imperative. So it could be making a statement, Rodney ran, or it could be making a command, Rodney run. Okay? But some verbs happen to be spelled the same. And you have to decide, is this making a statement or making a command? It's not all verbs are that way. But some Greek verbs are spelled the same when it is both a statement and a command. And you have to, and so they are not just translating, formally translating, very literalistically. They have to make interpretational decisions. So most of the time it's very simple. If it's in a list of commands, well, bingo. This one is certainly a command as well. But there are times when it's pretty tough. And there are translational decisions. I think I've spoken about this before. I watched a video. They took a video of the translation committee for the ESV. They are changed. They have changed. If you buy a brand new ESV, they have changed the word slave to bondservant. They are both legitimate translations of the Greek word doulos, but they initially, probably hurrying to press, left it as bondservant, left it as slave, and they wanted to change it to bondservant after lengthy discussion. And it was so fun to watch that. It's on YouTube. You can watch. And, you know, some of my theological heroes are in the room doing this thing. You know, so J.I. Packer is over there listening, doesn't say much. He's very elderly. You know, you can't tell if he's even awake or not. He's there, you know. Probably Bruce Ware is in the room, but the one that, Wayne Grudem. So I based all those theological lessons for all those years mostly on Wayne Grudem. You know, they're in there, you know, duking it out with their words. Some of them want to use slave because it's a stronger, more potent word, and others want to use the word bondservant because of all the connotations that go with, especially American plantation slavery, which is very different than slavery in the Bible. And then at the end, they just take a vote. And some of them win, and some of them lose, and they keep right on going. You know, and so it's hard, hard work to translate the Bible. The reason that I'm not a Bible translator is I don't have that capacity, you know. But they did that hard work in the King James. King James was one of the first, maybe the first, that was done by a large committee. So men would get assigned to either the Old or the New Testament part of the committee. And then they would get divided up, and they would be assigned to the minor prophets or to the major prophets or to the Pentateuch or to the Psalms, Proverbs, and other writings. And then they would get, okay, your job is to do Psalms, and your job is to do Proverbs, and then you switch and double-check each other. And just this lengthy, lengthy process. There's a book in our church library called God's Secretaries. I'm sorry. There's a book in the DeMott Library called God's Secretaries that's all about the committee translation of the King James Bible. It's very, very interesting. So, yes, the English words end up being sometimes very different. If you're reading the NIV and somebody else is reading the King James, you're going, whoa. But they started at the same place, basically, and are trying to express the same Greek sentences, but they're going to do it with different words. Yeah. And that's back to the Geneva Bible and the King James Bible. One of them is emphasizing more democratic principles, and one of them is emphasizing more divine right of kings principles. Well, you know. Right. So there are shades of meaning, and King James is over there going, "All right, guys, you know, let's." Right. Yeah. I mean, King James was trying to influence the translators towards more of authoritarian, top-down government through shading the translation. The other guys, the guys that did the Geneva translation, they're kind of, you know, rabble-rousers a little bit. You know, they're tired of serving the king, and so they're emphasizing something else. We interpret things, just even like sentences that I say in English, and you, my native language is English and your native language is English, but you have a grid through which you interpret those English words that I say and may interpret them differently than I mean them, and we don't even know that that's happening most of the time. So, yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes, languages evolve. And so, yes, when we, this is a pretty good example, similar, but it wasn't translation. But when we were writing a new doctrinal statement for our church, I tended to say, and want us to say as a church, that the Word of God is sufficient for all of our, I don't remember what we ended up saying, but sufficient for all of our faith and doctrine and practice or something as a church. And Don was reminding us as elders that, oh, well, that's sufficient, good enough, you know. He said, that's not what we want to say. So I think we ended up saying sufficient and invaluable. You know, it's not just sufficient, it's valuable. You know. Yes, completely sufficient is what it meant, yeah, years ago. So anyway, we got to keep moving. So Henry VIII died and left the throne to his son, Edward VI. But he only lived another 6 years after his father's death. But especially for the first 3 years, but also to some degree continuing after that, there were several strides made in the cause of Reformation. So you remember we've talked about communion before and how the Catholics withheld the cup of wine at that time, especially from the laity. So the cup of communion was restored to the laity during this time. The clergy were allowed to marry, and the statuary, the images, were removed from churches. There was a change in the second 3 years of his reign. However, other things continued to march forward regarding the Reformation. Especially, they changed the wording of what a minister was supposed to say during communion. So he was originally supposed to say, more Catholic influenced, he would hand you the bread and he would say, "The body of our Lord Jesus, which was given for thee, preserve thy body and soul unto everlasting life," which does a couple of things. It gives the impression that this cracker has now been changed into the body of our Lord, and it also gives the impression that salvation or preservation comes by virtue of taking communion. Well, they changed the wording to something that was much more Zwinglian. All right, so if you've been with us through these, you know that Luther and Zwingli both disagreed on what communion meant and the presence of Christ. Was he present in the cracker or not? And so this is what they said after this change in the Church of England: "Take and eat this in remembrance that Christ died for thee, and feed on him in thy heart by faith and with thanksgiving." So that's like really clear, isn't it? It's saying you're spiritually nourishing yourself on Christ, but just take this cracker and this cup to help you remember Jesus. So that's really good, and that's really strong. That's what we believe. Now, later they changed it back so that it was sort of like both put together. And you could interpret it more like leaning towards Catholics or Lutherans, and you could interpret it more like leaning towards Zwingli. But that's something that kind of played out there under Edward VI. Let me talk about Mary Tudor. So when Edward died, after only 6 years on the throne, then Mary Tudor, the daughter of Henry VIII and the first wife, his first wife, Catherine, took the throne. She pretty much hated the Reformation for a couple of different reasons. So eventually, the Parliament, with the support of the Reformers, declared that Henry VIII and Catherine, his wife, that their marriage was invalid. And so what does that make So if they conceived a child, but not within a valid marriage, what does that make her? It makes her illegitimate, and they refer to her as a bastard child at that point. Okay? It wasn't her fault, right? And it really wasn't Catherine's or Henry's fault. They were supposedly married at the time, right? But this becomes an invalid marriage so that he can go on and marry somebody else, etc., etc. But more than that, it cuts her off from any royal privileges. And it actually puts her life in danger. Well, when Edward VI dies, she's what's left. And so she takes the throne and she consolidates power around her. Once she has done that, she marries her cousin, who is a Catholic, Philip of Spain. And then she continues to kind of consolidate power, establish her position as Queen of England, and she begins to repress the Protestants, and quite severely. By 1554, England officially returned to obedience to the Pope as a nation. And all of these reforms under Henry VIII and Edward VI are beginning to be undone. So the churches now had to honor the feast days of the saints. They had the clergy who were married were ordered to set aside their wives. Almost 300 Protestants were burned for the faith, burned at the stake. Many others were exiled or imprisoned. Thomas Cranmer, remember, who had ordered the translation, was pushing for spiritual reformation in the churches, a Protestant reformation in the churches, was now condemned as a heretic along with Latimer and Ridley, two bishops. The queen, especially when it came to Cranmer, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, all right, so he was the highest ranking member of the clergy in England, she very much wanted him to recant of his heresy, to sort of prove to the population that all along he was wrong and he knew it. And so she didn't really want to kill him first. She wanted him to recant first. So she made him, from the prison tower, she made him watch while Latimer and Ridley were burned at the stake. Would have been horrible. One of them burned quickly, but because of the winds, another one burned very, very slowly, and it was just gut-wrenching to watch him not die, to be honest. By the way, if you were to be burned at the stake, you hoped for a hot, hot fire. It would steal all the oxygen, and you would die from asphyxiation long before you actually literally burned to death. That'd be true if you burned in a house or whatever. It's brutal to think about, but that's what you would pray for. That it just the winds wouldn't blow the fire away from you so that oxygen would be sucked into the fire and steal it from you and you could die quickly. That did not happen for one of these men. And so he had to watch that until the man finally died. And then finally, he did sign a statement of recantation, I guess is what it would be called. He did finally sign one. And then she wanted him to state that he was recanting publicly before they killed him anyway. So he was going to die anyway. But for whatever reason, he signed a statement recanting his beliefs. And but then he changed. He had a change of heart. Before the fire was lit, when everybody is expecting him to say, "I was wrong all along and I deserve to die for what I did," he said that I was wrong to sign that recantation, and I believe in the gospel, and I believe in the authority of the Word of God and in Jesus Christ, and I renounce the Catholic Church and the Pope. And he said, "This hand, my right hand with which I signed it, will be the first in the fire," and he stuck it in the fire first. So he publicly withdrew his recantation, which I'm sure frustrated Mary Tudor. So it was a brutal and difficult time for Protestants in England. She finally died in 1558, and she was succeeded by her half-sister Elizabeth. Mary Tudor was actually pretty committed to the Catholic faith. Elizabeth is in the same situation Mary Tudor had been in, because if her mother isn't a legitimate queen, then she herself is illegitimate, just like Mary Tudor had been, and all of these things. So more for political reasons, more so than her sister, but more for political reasons, she supports the Reformation, because she's kind of the opposite of her sister. So she, or half-sister. So Elizabeth was born to Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. And being more politically minded, she again wanted to break with Rome. So she is kind of just the political opposite of her sister. And so when the time came for her to be crowned queen, she didn't even notify Rome. She didn't give a rip what they thought. And she just called the ambassador back. The ambassador to the Vatican, she called back. So you kind of see, I have these little smaller bullet points. If Henry's marriage to Catherine was valid, and their child, Mary Tudor, was legitimate, then that made the marriage to Anne Boleyn invalid and made Elizabeth an illegitimate child. So she, for political reasons, supports the opposite of whatever Mary Tudor was. She was, however, a religious moderate, and she wanted this sort of big tent idea to the Church of England, to the Anglican faith, that you could be almost Roman Catholic, still inside the Anglican Church, and you could be a pretty strong Protestant, but you couldn't technically be a Roman Catholic and a, you know, just rabid Protestant and stay within the Anglican Church. So she wanted this kind of big tent with lots of room for lots of different people, lots of different beliefs within the Anglican Church. And that's kind of what she pushed towards. Towards the end of her life, she began indicating that Roman Catholics would be tolerated, that she would see a difference between, the Roman Catholic Christians or believers' loyalty to the Pope and their political loyalty to the crown. And so she was beginning to sort of give some political freedom, some religious freedom at that point. We're going to come back to this period of time eventually, but that's kind of her support for the Reformation for her various reasons. Any comments or questions? Go ahead.
So if neither one of them were technically legitimate at the time that they took the crown, how were they able to secure the crown and then go back and change to make themselves more legitimate?
So they would have had enough supporters in the government. So as long as the parliament went along with it, and parliament desperately needed somebody on the throne. If you're a legitimate possibility and you can get enough support, then you get it. Yeah. Anything else? Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so many people would refer to the English Reformation as a halfway Reformation. Okay, it never really repudiated Catholicism fully. So, do you guys know what a mitre is? A mitre is that funky looking hat that the Pope sometimes wears. It's real tall, and if you look at it from the side, it looks like a fish with his mouth open. I don't have to be especially reverent, do I? Okay. Some Anglican ministers dress a lot like we do when they preach. And some of them wear that robes and jewels and that funky hat and all kinds of fanciness. Okay. And it's, and, you know, so there are high church and low church Anglicans. There are, you know, Anglo-Catholics. And there are, you know, which is like a Catholic-leaning Anglican, basically. And then there are people like John Stott and J.I. Packer who preached the gospel relentlessly and worked for, you know, a full reformation in the church. But because it was a politically driven reformation, it's a lot like what we used to think of as the Republican Party, the Big Tent Party, right? That's just, you could be a social conservative, you could be a economic conservative, a fiscal conservative, and you'd find a place in the Republican Party. And then, you know, that same big tent idea religiously is what the Anglican Church has become. The Anglican Church has not taken a clear stand against homosexuality and the blessing of homosexual marriage. And because of that, some have split away and formed another, I can't remember the technical term, what they call it, but another fellowship of Anglican churches that is centered in Africa, actually, and that is growing. So J.I. Packer was kicked out of the Anglican, the official Anglican Church of England church. He was kicked out. They disciplined him because he was so clear and biblical on homosexuality. And he consequently went and joined one of those Anglican churches. Yes. It's called Episcopalian. Yeah. All right. There's not a lot going on that I want to highlight here in Scotland, but I think there is kind of a similar track that ends up with Reformation in Scotland, but we'll just quickly finish that next week. So save your pages, and I'll save what's left over there, and we'll be dismissed.